This is CliffCentral.com.
Here he is, Michael Jordan. I've been waiting to get him into the studio for, two, 3 years. I've been pestering him. And he replies, and he's so polite. He says, look, I'm really busy. I don't want to speak for any of the companies I invest in because I'm not on the management team necessarily. And then he says, look, I'm not available. I'm in Cape Town. You have done what hardly anyone in business does when they've had one incredible success story. And really what you did at FNB was nothing short of miraculous. Everybody said so. It wasn't my opinion. You were given awards all over the world. You positioned that bank in a way that they are still trying to mine the cred from. And then you could have just quietly gone and made wine and been, your own boss and not have been involved in much more from there on. But a restless spirit like yours, I suppose, has to keep busy. And you were just talking to me about startups. I mean, are you just one of those people, you get ideas and you have to try and make them happen?
So I'm going to answer you, but first of all, thanks for having me. It really is an honor. And you've said those nice things about FNB. I wish I could take credit for all of it. But the reality in life is if you have the guts to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you and you can empower them, amazing things can happen. So really what happened at FNB was that. I think there was a great team. We chose innovation. We allowed people to take risks and make mistakes. It's quite a big thing. Most corporates are set up to avoid mistakes.
Especially banks, huh?
Especially banks, and there are good reasons for it. Mm. But if you can manage those risks in a kind of acceptable framework, you can do quite amazing things. So I was really just lucky that there was a great team. And yes, you're right, then and I eventually left. I left off just under a decade as CEO of a big bank, which I also think is a good time. I think people should move on at some stage. You get presidents of countries that become power hungry and want to hang on for longer. You get CEOs who do it. You need to move on and create space for new people and new thoughts. So that was my first thought.
It's interesting you say
just
that.
To move on.
Yeah, because, and I'll let you finish the actual question that I asked in a second, but Prof. Jonathan Janssen said to me once, and I don't know whether he meant it for me, but I think he was saying it in a general sense. He said, if you keep doing the same thing, whether it's a job or you're mining an idea or whatever it might be for a certain number of years, and you find yourself still doing it and nothing's changed, you lack imagination.
Absolutely.
So maybe that's part of it too.
Absolutely. And I am going to get to the answer, but now you've triggered another thought, which was somebody who drove Malcolm Gladwell in a car on the way to making a speech here. And he said to Malcolm Gladwell, tell me something, I haven't read any of your books. And apparently he thought about it for quite a while. And he said, okay, if you still believe what you believed 10 years ago, then you are a fossil. Okay, that's quite a call for all of us. I used to grow up thinking that if you believe something really deeply, you are probably clever and you're going to be right more often. But life doesn't work like that. To be right more often, you have to be able to change your mind when new things come up. And that's so. It's the same thing as you can't be in a job for 10 years. You must just question all your beliefs because so many new facts have emerged in the scene.
And these days, there's no excuse for willful ignorance. I mean, things are being discovered all the time, but old knowledge is available in ways that it never was for ordinary people.
You see, I think it's less about knowledge, and it's that it's tough to let some of your old beliefs go. People sometimes believe something new, but if you used to believe that, fat was bad for you, and somebody says, no, but a high-fat diet is good for you, it's difficult to just change your behaviors.
Especially if you incorporate that into identity, and so many people do. They take that stuff, whether it's belonging to this group, whether it's having this religion, whether it's believing money is a certain thing. Yeah. And then they struggle to break those chains because they consider it part of who they are.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's part of your identity. There's this venture capitalist, Marc Andreessen, that coined the phrase, strong convictions weakly held. I always thought that's a great way to say it. So it's not that you go around not having views or opinions. You can have very strong opinions. But if somebody confronts you with facts that actually say the opposite is true, you should be able to say, well, I didn't know about that, and I've changed my mind. And those are the people that are right more often. So to come back to your original question, I left to be frank, I didn't have a clear idea on exactly what I was going to do, but I know that startups have always fascinated me. I'm lucky that FirstRand, where I grew up in a corporate world, was still managed by the people who founded Rand Merchant Bank. And their founder's ethos was still very strong. And it was encouraged us to start businesses in the big corporate umbrella. So some of the stories would have been Discovery and Assurance.
Those guys have changed the landscape of South African business.
They absolutely have. And the level of intellect in those companies is incredibly high. But so we tried to emulate them within, let's say, FNB. So there were actually startups within FNB. Let's say cell phone banking that had never existed before. Obviously, you had the privilege of using a brand and a customer base and the infrastructure and the capital and so on. But there was some form of entrepreneurial thinking. And I could see how well some of those ventures had grown.
Yeah.
And came to the conclusion that the best way to ever change society with a new idea that you have is actually to use the humble little startup, to use the vehicle and to start executing on it. Now, it's not easy. It carries high risks. It also, if it works well, can, you know, give you high rewards. And I just kind of got involved in startups. And I've got about 25 of them now. Some
of them are better known than others. There's some I want to talk about. But yeah, it's a wide range of stuff too.
And you know what? Not all of them will make it. There's a power law in startups. They say that as an investor, and I'm privileged that I'm invested in more than one, that one or two out of 10 will make up for the failures of four or five out of that 10. And that's just kind of been in existence for 40 years in venture capital. So you have to make peace with the fact as an investor that this is not about getting lots of good performance. This is getting one or two companies that have absolutely awesome performance and some may just not make it. That's the nature of the game.
But business leaders and people who have managed businesses to great success or have been investors, early investors in startups, they are the new rock stars. I mean, this is an amazing thing. It never,
I think
70 years ago, 50 years ago, even 20 years ago,
yeah.
The people in, sure, they did well, but their reward was the material success that brought. They didn't get treated like the rock star CEOs of today. I mean, it's a whole different
world.
It's
become very cool.
Yeah.
There are idols or role models out there. You know, everybody wants to be a Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or whatever. And certainly where I grew up in Pretoria at a kind of Afrikaans school, what people would tell you is to study hard and get a job,
right?
You know? And the words were always just, you must have something to fall back on. But what people really wanted to say is, don't fall back on it, do it. You know, why would you not want to have a great job at a great brand? And that is all about risk minimization. And if I could go back to a matric class now and ask me what would I tell them, I would say take risks. I think people don't understand that the quality of your life is directly proportionate to the amount of risks that you would take.
And it's safe to take risks in 2018. It wasn't when we were cavemen. You took a risk, then you'd be eaten by
something.
That's
exactly right.
You know, now that kind of behavior will create an opportunity for an outlier to do an extremely interesting thing. Before, it would have been a surefire way to get yourself thrown out of the tribe and killed.
So, first of all, if you're young, you can afford to take so many risks. I mean, what are you going to lose? Let's say you start a business and it doesn't work out when you were 18 and now you're 19. You would have learned so much. You would have learned more in that year where your business didn't work out than you could learn in a year doing a formal MBA. So, the first one is, it's not that bad. But I think what we have to fight here is probably this stigma that we have in South Africa that is attached to failure, that you don't accept if somebody has failed once that they could learn from that experience and do it again. Now, I'm not talking stupid failure. I mean, sometimes people really do stupid things. But if you're not willing to take that chance, willing to experiment, do something different, first of all, you may not have the kind of reward of a business that works out, but you're not going to have the high-quality life. And the quality of your life really depends on the risks that you take. Are you going to ask that girl for a dance? Are you going to travel to another country? Are you going to learn a new language? Are you going to kind of ask questions about something that you don't understand? I mean, the alternative is you lock yourself in a small little dark room. You don't take the risk of crossing the road or ever speaking to a stranger. But your quality of your life is going to be terrible if you do that.
But that's such an interesting way of looking at things, because what you're actually telling people to do is to break out of the norm. And they read business books so that they can mitigate risk. I can learn from other people's mistakes.
Yeah.
But actually, that's exactly the opposite. If you're a risk taker, you don't read the book. You go, I really believe for X and Y and Z reason, you've thought it through. It's not just going to be a blind gamble. This is what I think is missing. This is what needs to be done.
So I think there are two parts of it. The one is, if you want to embrace something new, That is risky in itself. Things are going to go wrong. It's new. No one else has tried it. At the same, so entrepreneurs are risk takers, but at the same time, they're smart people, and they do know that they can minimize their risks, particularly by learning more about the topic, ideally than anyone you know, and learning from other people's mistakes. So I'm definitely not saying just take wild risks. I'm saying take smart, calculated risks mm-hmm. and reduce them by being so knowledgeable about the topic that you can take so many other risks off the table. That doesn't mean overall it can still be highly risky. It can be highly risky to start podcasts, you know, leaving a kind of a big organization to do so. But what I can tell you is the thrill of doing it, the feeling of being alive, the feeling of creating something new, of having a mission. Now, I don't want to make this sound too soppy, but actually really making the world a little bit better in the process is just incredibly intoxicating.
So I don't want to dwell on this, but if I go back a couple of years to when you were trusted to turn a fairly ordinary bank into something very 21st century, and with all the love in the world, again, and I don't mean to blow smoke up your ass, but every other bank CEO since you has been really just trying to do what you did. And somehow you got it right then, at a time where it wasn't the norm. And the environment in banking was strict rules, procedures. People kind of followed the process. They didn't step out of that. How did you change that? Because that's a massive dinosaur to turn, you know? It's like riding a brontosaurus. You can pull that rein, the brontosaurus doesn't care.
Look, I can tell you long...
You said the team, so yeah, I understand.
And it really was the team, and it was, as I said, I really felt that in each of their fields, they were smarter than me and better than me, but I didn't feel threatened by that at all, which, by the way, is an important thing as a leader, is to not feel threatened to surround yourself with people who are better than you.
Ego, right?
I think ego gets in the way. So people are either too convicted of their own views, or they don't have the strength of character to be shown up in a meeting. I mean, it took me a long while to understand that in meetings, I don't have to come up with the right decision. I just have to facilitate the best decision to be made. And there's so much depth in, you know, that group. So first of all, I was lucky with the team. Or I say lucky, obviously as a leader, you have to decide who you surround yourself with. So, you know, sometimes you bring new people on board and there are times where you have to tell somebody that, you know, it's not working out. And then secondly, I was lucky that we still had this founder's ethos where they did encourage us to innovate and to do things differently. But it was a long process. It's like, you know, seeing a chicken being born out of a shell. It looks miraculous. It all happens at that moment. But there's a long gestation period, and, you know, there's even more involved in kind of getting a hen to lay a chicken and an egg in the first place. So we had decided as a team, long before it became sexy to be innovative, that that would be the one thing that we were going to do. And we put it in our scorecards. You know, I said, I want to be measured on this. And everybody in my team was accountable amongst all the other things like customer satisfaction and employee satisfaction and ROEs and all those other things to also innovate. And we started counting these things. And we made many mistakes. But the mere fact that we said this is something that we care about means it then eventually happens. What you measure eventually gets done.
Yeah, you make it sound perfectly well thought through and sensible, but it must also been quite a lot of occasions and perhaps even real practical mistakes that were met with nothing but antagonism and instant repulsion by people who were either above or below you in that food chain. You must have also thought once or twice, I've screwed up badly here.
Yeah, definitely. And now what happens in that situation is really important. You can now either affirm the culture that you have or you can kill it. The way to kill it is then to shoot the messenger or blame the person who did something wrong. The way to strengthen it is to say that the buck stops with you yourself. So as CEO, when mistakes were made, I would at the board meeting not try and say, look, I'm the clever guy and somebody else made a mistake. I said, listen, it's my mistake. You know, I owned up for it. Didn't mean that there weren't consequences later on for those individuals on a one-on-one basis. But if you could strengthen the culture that people knew in this environment, someone has their back if they make a clever mistake, then it becomes really amazing what they A, will do for you as a leader, but B, how it strengthens their resolve to really try new things and to innovate more. Now, I say that so glibly. I didn't start out like that as a leader. I mean, in the beginning, I really wanted to impress everyone on the board and so on. It was only after a while that one gets the confidence that you can actually say, any mistakes, buck stops with me, you know. Any credit where things go well, that you must give away, you know, and you must give it to other people in front of their peers, because it's the most amazing motivating factor if you tell them they've done well in front of other people.
This is a mastery of ego. Like, and I don't mean to distill it to just one thing, because it's probably a lot of different factors, but that is something that some people either never attain in their lives, or some people gain, and you never completely control it, because you're a mammal with a reptile brain deep down inside.
Sure.
But it seems to me like somewhere along your path, you learned to let, you became the master of your ego rather than letting your ego become the master of you. So do you think that happened? Was it stuff that you learned as a kid? Was it experiences in the workplace? Was it stuff you read? How did you come to this stuff?
Probably all of the above. I mean, I'm a nerd, so I love reading, you know, so history and biographies and other business books and so on. But there's nothing like being in the driver's seat or being in the hot seat of being a CEO. And, you know, having pressure, having things go wrong, sometimes things go well, lots of conflict, inevitable politics, things that you have in a big business, and then thinking about it deeply, you know, not just at work, but sometimes when you're on your mountain bike or you know, kind of having a jog and saying, how could I have done that better? I was also lucky that there were people around me who could give me input. I mean, there were some people who could take me aside and say, Michael, you know, don't do something like that, or don't be so partisan about this, or think about it differently. But the breakthrough really came for me when this point I made earlier is, I don't have to always come up with the decisions. There were so many cases where I realized that if I went to the team and said, guys, ladies, I think this is our problem. Is this our problem? We'll talk about it and say, what is the solution? I think this is the solution. And I had to completely let go of my ego. You're quite right. Because mostly they would tell me, Michael, your idea isn't good enough. And in the beginning, I would say, but do you know who I am? Those terrible words.
Yeah, people, because that's your initial reaction.
It's your initial reaction. And then after a while you realize, but if you let go of this and you invite people in, the solution you come up with is just so much better. Yeah. And you just have to witness that once or twice in practice that you become converted, and then it becomes quite an easy habit.
But also history's been full of these egomaniacs and narcissists, right?
Yeah.
So we always equate success with someone who seems to know everything, even though they're probably having huge internal conflicts.
Yeah, that's right.
And we've seen empires rise and fall because of this kind of thing. Usually, ultimately, they fall because, you know, it becomes hubris. But it's interesting that you were hungry for all of this information, that you were a nerd, before nerds became a cool thing. I mean, were you like this at school? What kind of guy were you at?
Yeah, I think so. I think I was a nerd or a geek or whatever word you want to use. I still am. And I like ideas. I like interesting discussions with people. Really like thinking deeply about something and understanding something. I'm very uncomfortable, by the way, talking about something that I don't know. And I'm very happy to let somebody else take the lead in there. So particularly if it's something practical and so on. You know, I don't try and be a leader in all situations. It's just the ones that you deeply understand.
Yeah, but you also challenge conventions. And that takes some bravery, some courage, because, you know, in something like banking or with Rain, for example, which is obviously challenging some pretty big players in a very cushy situation for themselves, you come into that world, you're going to be the little guy, even if you have a reputation like yours.
Yeah, in nearly all of these startups, there are strong views that it'll never work. Where we have had feedback from people that you would ordinarily listen to, and then you have to make that call. Am I being crazy? Or, you know, is there something they don't see? Are they, you know, maybe formed too much by the status quo? And, you know, why am I willing then to bet on something new? Now, I am particularly interested in these cases where really small startups can challenge the big guys, the old David versus Goliath thing. But you can't just do it for the sake of it. You've got to say that there is something that we have that they don't have. There's something in our DNA that would be very difficult for them to do. One of them, for example, is price.
Yes.
when you're a big company, it really is tough to cut your what we call legacy income streams. You know, it's to say, but, you know, I've always made a lot of money out of that. Okay, there's a small new competitor, their prices are different. It's really, really tough to say, I'm going to just be ruthless about it and cut it. I think in the States, big companies are far more likely to do it than it is in South Africa. So that's one of the things that I'm very interested in is situations where you can use new technology, have a very low cost base, and then challenge some of the big guys out there. The cool thing about it is that consumers can benefit hugely in the process. But it's early days. Let's see how it goes with my startups.
Yeah, but with all of these startups, there seems to be also a common thread in that you're doing something for people that either isn't being done yet or that you could do better.
Yeah, that's what you want to do. And you can't just do it 1 or 2 or 5% better. You want to find something that does it multiple times better than it's currently being done. Mm. So if you take Uber, it sounds silly that you just kind of order a cab on a phone in a way. I don't know, how many times is that better? I think it's multiple times better because they come to you wherever you are. You see how far away they are. You're on the map. They tell you how long it's going to take to get there.
Just today I left before I came to interview you now. I had a lunch meeting and I didn't have to get a ticket from the parking thing because I had an app that just opened the boom. And then when I came out, the app opened the boom again and my credit card gets debited. No stress from my side. Yeah. Didn't have to stand in a queue at the machine. Then the machine isn't working. I mean, that would have ruined my whole experience. It made my life infinitely better.
Yeah.
It's little things like that, right?
Yeah. But you have to make the consumer experience significantly better for them to change their behavior. So I think we've covered a few things now for, you know, which are the startups that are interesting. Technology often makes a difference. Price, which you can only do if you have a significantly lower cost structure. And then you've got to think hard about the consumer and what is, you know, what are the benefits for the consumer other than price that will make their life so much more convenient. Now, the wonderful thing is our lives are getting richer and better. And there are so many of these things that come to us typically through apps and the mobile revolution. But there's just so much more that you can do in South Africa in particular. And I think the frustrating thing nearly is you see all these solutions everywhere and you're frustrated that things aren't happening fast enough. So why isn't solar adoption happening quicker and we're not using coal? Why are textbooks still not getting to kids' schools when you could just give them a pad or an iPad or any other device and you have all the textbooks there and it's cheaper for them and it's not delayed, you know? Why are the data costs not coming down and banking fees not coming down, et cetera, et cetera? It's exciting,
but
it's also very frustrating.
And you can't solve all the problems.
Yeah, it's just a
you got to pick your battles,
you see,
right?
So let's just take education, where South Africa has this dismal performance in all the international ratings, where amongst, I think it's 190 countries that participate in these ratings, when it's maths and science, we are close to 190. Mm. Now, this is not where we should have been so many years after democracy in the country.
We have the highest levels of innumeracy and illiteracy on this continent.
Yeah, and it's sad, right? I mean, anyone
horrendous.
Who's done well
it's a human
in the
rights
world,
abuse. It's not just sad.
I agree with you, and I think it's a very sad human rights abuse because we are it's a whole generation of South Africans that have not been given the tools to empower and liberate themselves and thrive and, you know, live in a whole different world. So I think that is the type of frustration. I mean, education is just one example, but you could have the same thing with crime, for example, or you could have it for you know, giving people access to entertainment that, you know, other people just take for granted elsewhere in the world because, you know, data costs are lower and so on. So if you are a successful entrepreneur, you have to live in the future and not just in your own discipline, not just in podcasting, but you have to say, I want to try a Tesla. I want to see what electric car feels like. I am going to put a solar panel on my roof. I just want to see, you know, whether that's going to work. And the moment you start living in the future, you wish you could just accelerate everything that would solve the problems of today. There's this famous saying about the future is already here. It's only unevenly distributed. So it's all out there. And the frustration is just how do you take all of that and you bring it to today and you solve so many of the problems that we have.
But that frustration for some people manifests as like unbearable impatience. And for a lot of people, it's overwhelming because they see an answer to a very obvious question. They know they can solve it, but they don't have the resources necessarily to solve all of these problems.
Yeah.
And then instead of it motivating them to make change happen, they lose moot.
Yeah.
They give up.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
So I just think they shouldn't. They should carry on, even if you can do something on a very, very small scale, and then just improve it incrementally from there. So this would be my advice to would-be entrepreneurs out there, is don't think big in the beginning. Facebook is now huge. It's got, I don't know, 2 billion people using it. Was it 1 billion monthly users? But it started as a Facebook for one dorm in one college, and then went to another college, and then to another college. It started small. Amazon is now the everything store. You can get anything on Amazon. It started as one website, and you should actually have a look at that website when they launched, just selling books. And now you can get anything on it. So start small and make it work. If I may just go back to education, I mean, a lot of well-meaning people have solutions for education in South Africa, but they always, to me, seem too grand. And I would say, if you think you've got a way of solving it, why don't you solve it just in one school to prove it? And actually, not just in one school, but in one grade in one school. And actually, not just in one grade, but one class in one grade. And actually, not just in one class, but one subject. Do it in one classroom with one teacher, with one subject. Show us that that approach works. And if it doesn't, it's obvious to take it to the next subject or the next classroom or the next grade or the next school.
Because there's already a structure to scale it.
That's exactly right. And this is where startups are so cool. You don't try and solve everything, every problem. You just try and pinpoint a problem with something unique, solve it, and then use the learnings that you've had there to take it to the next level. And that's why, ultimately, I said I'm frustrated, but I'm also incredibly positive about the things that I see, because there are so many well-meaning people that are doing this, starting small, starting humble. Right now, you haven't heard of so many of them, but they're going to be huge. Just like the big companies of today, the Facebooks and the Apples and the Instagrams and the WhatsApps, didn't exist 15 years ago. So there are things being invented today that in 10 years' time will irrevocably change the world for the better.
This brings to a conclusion our business section of the discussion. If you are one of those people who likes business information, maybe you could stop now. No, I'm kidding, obviously, because there's so much it's all intertwined. What I want to know, though, is what kind of a day you have, because everything, you're involved in so many different things. I think you're very stimulated. I think you keep looking for more that interests you. So it's not as if you're full. But what kind of a day do you have? do you wake up at the same time every day? Do you have a routine, or do you go into a different, depending on what you've got on that day? It varies from day to day.
I take my kids to school.
Right,
that's
very sensible.
So there's a certain time of the day that we wake up, which is just after 6 o'clock, and then my wife and I...
You listen to Tim Ferriss, you know, he has this thing, he drinks lemon water, and then there's, you know, there are these guys who you hear that they have this routine, they meditate for 20 minutes. I mean, is that possible?
I think those things are really, really good. I think I'm just not, you know, good enough to do them.
I've tried.
My basic thing is like, who's going to make tea? Is it going to be my wife or me? And it's either ching chong chai or 50-50, you know, and I need that caffeine kick. Take my kids to school, and then I'm in the office pretty early. I don't have a structured day.
But hang on, your office isn't at home?
It's in town.
Okay. Is it important to separate the home and the office?
Yeah, I think very, very important, because you need some forms of thinking require deeper thought, and you only get into that after a certain amount of time. And if the phone rings or somebody speaks to you, it could take you up to 45 minutes to get into the flow again.
Okay, so what do you do in traffic? What are you listening to? What are you thinking?
Look, our traffic in Stellenbosch is not that bad. Okay. You get to the office
10 minutes?
10 minutes.
Okay.
You know, obviously with my kids, it's a great time to talk to them.
But for me, that is, you know, I'm driving on my own often, so that is my meditation time. That's where I think about what I want to do that day, what I need to achieve, who I need to talk to, all that kind of thing. So it's almost just a selfish time to clear your head.
You need that. We all need that. I think one of the bad things that we do, that most people do, is you kind of fire up your PC or your laptop and you start doing your mails.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, that immediately sucks you in with other people's priorities, because they've now mailed you, so they've made their priorities your priorities. Whereas what you should really do is just take whatever time it takes to say, what are my priorities? What do I want to achieve out of today? Just that one life hack, I think, is one of the most important things that you can do.
Do you actually write a little list?
You write a little list in your book, and you say, I want to do these seven things, and you just keep on going back to them in the day. Now, look, I'm not saying I'm doing that perfectly. But
I'm not going to hold you to any of this.
But the important thing is don't just open up your laptop and start doing emails, because that way you're going to get lots of small things done, but you could miss some of the really important things.
All right, but then people who don't know that you can do more in a day. Let's say people who have a very routine job, and we're not criticizing those people at all. Sometimes that's absolutely what we need.
Absolutely.
We want someone who's running the nuclear plant to have a routine.
I was thinking of the same example. You know, you follow your procedures, please.
Please. But they look at all these different companies, you know, from Rain to Montegrade to the Bank Zero to your wine, and they think, how does all of this figure? I mean, do you have different people who report to you? Do you deal with each thing as it comes?
So I spoke earlier about surrounding yourself with people that are better than you, people that are great. So that's what I try and do. So I wouldn't invest in any business, even if I think the idea is great, if I didn't think it was run by an individual or a team that's also great.
But a person who doesn't understand that would say, well, what's your function then?
No, so my function is really to be back up there, to if somebody, you know, has a strategy that they want to talk through, or that a difficult situation in their business happens, any type of event, I like to be there as a free resource that they could just access and say, what would you do in this situation? And often in those situations, I could come up with ideas that may not be what they end up doing in any event. So definitely isn't thou shalt type of situation.
No, sure. But what happens on a day where they don't bring you any problems?
I do try and think and read and take particular topics that I say I would like to know more about how, I don't know, 4G technology is going to develop into 5G technology and what the opportunities are going to be, or how startup banks abroad, what functionality did they have that was highly valuable to the customers that the legacy banks didn't do, and what switching processes did they have to make it easy for people to move across from banks. And so
let me understand, those questions fascinate you.
Yeah.
It's not homework. You're not doing this because you need to, in order to make a success of the things you're invested in.
No, it's like a puzzle that needs to be solved.
Yeah.
It's like,
you're obsessed with solving the puzzle.
Solving the problems and making things better. And as you know, sometimes something that looks very easy in the end is only the result of really deep and sophisticated and complex thinking that happens at the back of it. So I actually try not, you know, meet too many people, see too many people, you know, drink too many coffees, you know, when you get these coffee invites on email. But, you know, every now and then something...
Please, you don't even want to come and do a podcast with me for like 2.5 years.
But every now and then something really interesting, Gareth, like this discussion that you're having now penetrates, and then you take it further. I have to say, I learned so much as well becoming a venture capitalist. I had a little bit of capital and I said, I'm going to invest it in the businesses. I've done all I have now, by the way, which is very liberating to not have more capital to invest, and you can just look after
investments. From the quantum you decided you were going to be playing with, in inverted commas, as a venture capitalist, that is now
it is done.
All committed.
So it's unfortunately, or maybe fortunately for me, because...
Ooh, I can imagine you lying in bed at night and some great idea.
I know. That is something new comes along and
then inevitably... your poor children will have to go to a cheap school because you'll pull them out.
Inevitably, the ideas that I now see or I'm confronted with are better than some of the things that, you know, I saw early on. So this too, for me, has been a process of education. Remember, I came out of a bank where if you lend somebody money and you make a mistake 1 or 2 or 3% of the time, maybe that's still okay, bad debt ratio, but if it's 4, 5, or 6%, the bank can go under. So you try and minimize, you know, those mistakes. Whereas in venture capital, what I spoke about earlier is 50% of your investments could go bad. Provided that 1 or 2 or 3 out of the 10 compensate for all of that, that's fine. So it's a completely different world. I had to learn. I mean, I went to Silicon Valley, where I do think the Americans have really figured this thing out, you know, risk and backing teams and coming up with crazy new ideas, inventing the future. And there they said that to be a venture capitalist, you first need to lose $60 million. Now, that's just one of their sayings. I don't know how much science was behind that particular figure. But you kind of, with the best will in the world, with the best kind of reading and science behind you, you do make those type of mistakes. And after a while, you kind of just get better at it. And my biggest insight has just been to not back ideas. Now, that sounds silly, right? I love ideas. I said I'm a nerd. I mean, we can talk about ideas all day long, but ideas are actually the easiest bit. In fact, ideas are cheap. Yeah. Ideas are available everywhere. You can Google ideas on and then any topic, have hundreds, if not thousands of ideas.
If Da Vinci had just had the idea of the Mona Lisa,
there we go.
What would we have to show?
That's a great example.
You know?
So it's not about ideas. And this is kind of an unfortunate thing because people stand around the braai and they come up with an idea, or they have a glass of wine with their mates and they come up with an idea and they think it's the best idea ever. And my message out there would be the idea is maybe 1% of it. 99% is actually then how you execute on it, how you implement it. And that's tough. It really is hard.
And some of it's kind of boring. Like, some of the execution is boring.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, paying attention grudging to cash flow and and looking after your staff. Some of this stuff is not always the most exciting. And they don't. When people think of entrepreneurs and they think of venture capitalists and they think of people like you, they don't imagine you doing the drudgery.
Yeah, it sounds very glamorous. It's not glamorous at all. I mean, you have to go and, you know, buy your own paper for the printer at ShopRite, and then you have to fit it yourself and get the Wi-Fi hooked up, and so things that you can't do in a corporate.
You dealing with like a router in your office.
It would take me 3 hours to do what somebody who knew how to set up routers could do in 3 minutes. But you are quite right, and I think it's important to tell would-be entrepreneurs out there that there are those glamour moments, maybe the product launch or, you know, the first sale to a customer.
But the photocopying machine doesn't work, you're in a little startup, you have to fix it.
And you have to deal with customer complaints yourself. You have to be really good at sales. So execution is the real thing. And you can even implement a pretty average idea really well and build a great business. I'd rather have an average idea implemented incredibly well than a great idea implemented badly.
People also look at you now and they go, okay, now he's involved in all these startups. And it's not like you weren't doing anything between when you left the corporate world and you started investing in these businesses. It's not like you were sitting on your hands for that time. Because that's what a lot of people think. And again, I'm making a supposition here. But I would imagine, and when I talk to people who want to do well, a lot of them will go, well, once I've done well, then I can retire with lots of money. Then my life is complete. As if that's the...
Yeah, the ultimate. The ultimate
station
aim.
Get off the train at.
Look, Gareth, I'm in an incredibly privileged position that I can now do what I want to, that I had a little bit of capital to invest in some of these startups. It's become a bit of a mission, and I didn't set out to do it like that, but most of them are directed at solving some of the bigger problems that I think we have in South Africa. You know, I think high data costs is a really big issue because it prevents us growing. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that says the higher the access to the internet, to broadband, the higher your rate of economic growth, plus all the benefits of education. And I don't know, farmers can see what prices are, and fishermen can see, you know, what they sell their fish at, etc. So data is one. I think making banking easier and cheaper, particularly for small businesses, because it's small businesses that are going to create the jobs in South Africa. Solving for education by, you know, giving people access to electronic textbooks. And so it has happened, as I say, not by design, but it turned out, and I can only see it later now, that I particularly liked entrepreneurial solutions to some of the big problems that we have in South Africa. And once I realized that, you nearly become... it's more than passionate. You nearly become obsessed with solving these things. You know, I become obsessed with saying, do people really know that solar is now cheaper than Eskom if you use it in the daytime? It isn't, by the way, if you have to install a battery.
Everything's cheaper than Eskom now. They're $300 billion in debt.
That hasn't even fully been priced in because it has a government guarantee. And it's one of the big issues in the South African economy. But solar is cheaper. Mm. On top of that, it's green. Now, it means if you have kind of sense, you do realize that climate change is a reality in the world. I know there are people who want to deny it, but if you do the research, if you read deeply about it, the scientists will tell you that it's very, very real. We can stop burning coal. We can burn less coal, and it's cheaper to use solar power a day. So, you know, that's something that not a lot of people know. A lot of people don't want to change their behavior. Some people think you need to go completely off the grid. I'm sketching to you just one of the complex problems that we have in South Africa. And there's always a startup or more that can help solve this problem. And I've just become, as I say, obsessed with these solutions because I think they can all be solved and they can sustainably be solved in a way that, you know, if somebody can make money out of it, that doesn't bankrupt the country, that's good for the world. So why wouldn't you get obsessed about solving something like that?
So how would you, like with rain, for example, with data? I mean, the argument, I couldn't agree with you more, that we've got to find ways of making data, cheaper data, available to more people in South Africa. And there's clearly, right from the person who earns the least to the person who earns the most in South Africa, an understanding that data is an empowering thing.
Yeah.
So how does Rain go about this? And how's it going to do it better than the big established corporations?
So I'm so excited about this. You're going to have to tell me to stop.
But, go on.
One of our insights was, people don't like bundles. You buy these things in bundles, and then if you don't use it all, then it expires. So maybe milk should expire, but why data or voice?
No.
If you go
not like
you
get frayed at the edges and
there's none of that.
To throw it out because it's not looking bad.
it's a commodity. Then the second thing, then if you use more than your bundle, then you pay out-of-bundle penalties, yeah. Which is also a bizarre concept because actually if your customers use more of your product, if anything, you should let them have it at a lower price.
Not penalize them.
So anyway, the first thing that we did with Rain is we said we don't want to have bundles. We just want people to pay for what they use after they have used it. That's it.
It's
simple.
Brilliant.
So not more, not less if it's out of bundle. And then we also said we don't want wealthy people to pay less, but poor people to pay more, which is also one of the facets of the South African market. So if you buy small bundles, your price per megabyte or per gig is actually much higher than if you buy these
perverse,
big bundles.
It's perverse, right? You're punishing the people who can least afford
it. Exactly right. So, I mean, we haven't really spoken about that a lot, but in a kind of democratic sense, what we're trying to do with Rain is, you know, democratize data so that everybody pays the same.
By the way, everything so far sounds completely logical,
yeah.
Which makes me question the motives of the people who started this industry.
Yeah, so look, what
and I set those rules in the first.
I'm not going to have a go at them, and it's also one of the things that I've learned in life is, you know, kind of rather focus on the things that you want
to
do.
Each his own.
So, we just didn't want these bundles, and we didn't want out of bundle, and we didn't want expiry, and we just want everybody to have one simple price, because that may be the other point, all these packages, it confuses everybody. So that's step number one. Step number two was the technology thing where we said we're going to go data only. Now, that's quite a brave thing because people still make phone calls. In our world, we said that if we go data only, people can make phone calls over data that's much cheaper. If you make a WhatsApp phone call, it's 2 cents versus the, I don't know, 99 cents per minute that if you do it the old way. So there is a new way of calling, and there we took the risk of trying to do it in the new way. And that's kind of an educational process that, you know, we'll probably still have to advertise that, saying you can't phone the old way, but just use, and it doesn't have to be WhatsApp.
It can be Skype. You must have been the most excited person, even though everybody else thought this last Apple launch was so boring.
Yeah.
Because they've said you can have a dual SIM.
Yeah.
Now, that would be great for someone who wants to use data on
That's
one,
exactly right.
Calls on the other. So you were the only person in the whole of South Africa who went, what a great launch.
I, in fact, had heard rumors even before the launch that this could happen and predicted it and was very excited that it then eventually did happen. And you are exactly right that some people who still have the anxiety that they want the old way of doing it can now also have a second data SIM. And you can actually do the settings as such that you say, if I get a traditional old call, it's going to go to my old SIM. But whenever there is Rain data available, you know, it's going to default to do Rain data first. And again, I didn't even mention at a lower rate, but it's at a lower rate, only for what I use. And there's no out of bundle, doesn't expire, etc.
Fantastic. So it's a real value proposition.
We think so. So I spoke earlier about things can't just be a little bit better for consumers. They've got to be factors better. And this is what we're trying to do by focusing on data only and making it factors better. Clearly, our big challenge now is still rolling it out nationwide. It's not nationwide yet. It's only in big metropolitan areas. And that takes time. You know, we're a startup. You know, the other guys have had many, many years of kind of rollout. And that's a big technical challenge. There's a whole team busy with it. It's a capital challenge because you have to invest in doing it. But again, the joy of bringing data to South Africans and seeing how it's being used. We've hooked up many schools, for example. The demand for data is infinite. Worldwide, it's growing at 60% compound per year. It's been doing so for 20 years. And actually, people don't know when it's going to stop. You know, people are going to watch their TVs and it's going to be high definition. We're going to be talking to each other and it's going to be video chats all the time. The entertainment that people want all the time, education, you know,
virtual reality, augmented reality, machine learning, big data, all of this stuff requires a whole lot of data.
So you think
input.
Of schools and you're a kid now and you don't understand this particular version of Pythagoras, you can just get access to the best teacher in the world, not the one that you have at your school, and they can explain it to you. And you can learn it at your own pace. I mean, you can completely see it the day where every kid in the class is doing it at their own pace.
Yeah.
They could even be doing on subjects using data connectivity. So anyway, it's an incredibly exciting space that data consumption is growing at 60% compound. It could do so even faster in South Africa because we're a little bit behind some of the data utilization that you see in some of the developed market. And it's exciting to know that not only can we change people's lives through education, that we can improve economic growth, I think it's more substantive than that. And that is that the biggest divide that the world will have in future are people that are connected to the internet and people that are not. If you cannot connect to the internet, you are actually, for all intents and purposes, lost to this world. You can't listen to Cliff Central, but you also don't know what the weather's going to be like tomorrow. You are dependent on your news from one or two kind of sources. And once you're connected to the world, you have access to nearly everything. You have the best professors. You have the best news in the world. It's all at your disposal. So breaking down that barrier to a world where everybody has access to broadband is actually incredibly important from a human rights perspective.
I mean, why? Because again, you had a German passport when we were younger. You could have gone anywhere in the world. Some people would say, well, if you'd done this in America, you'd already be a dollar billionaire. This country, though, has a unique set of opportunities, right?
Yeah, sure.
And you don't see. I follow you on Twitter. You don't get into that complaining cycle that so many people do.
It doesn't help to point fingers or complain.
No, and I see, like, it's South Africa's favorite sport. Forget about rugby. It's complaining. You believe that for whatever reason, you're here now, you understand this landscape better than anyone, right? Or better than you would somewhere else. There's an enormous opportunity here.
And it's so exciting because it sounds like such a cliche, but every problem out there is actually has a solution to it. And you just look at the world differently if you say, okay, we have a problem at Eskom, it's got our debt load, it's burning a lot of coal, but there's a solution at solar.
Yeah.
You could say that Cape Town has a problem because it hasn't rained. Fortunately, it has rained now, it's dry. But there's a solution which is chopping down all the invasive alien trees that are around there, which, by the way, also create jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do the sums, it's not such
a wood.
And a whole lot of wood for winter. And so it's not a bad idea. Now, or you could desalinate the water using solar power. My point, and we must debate all of these things and find out whether they're affordable and so on, but they're solutions. They are always solutions.
People get stuck in the problem part, though.
That's right.
They don't see, if we did any of these things to solve these problems, we could end up not only making it better for everyone else, but also making it better for ourselves.
Just punting a brand here that I have nothing to do with, but I loved how OUTsurance started fixing potholes.
Yes, and then they had their people, their pointsmen.
And then they had the pointsmen, which there were occasions where trying to get out of traffic, you're so grateful for the hours that they, you know, kind of saved you. Now, that's an example of instead of complaining about traffic, somebody went out, did something about it in a way that probably lifted their brand as well, but that's fine. You know, they've solved the problem, they've done something for themselves, and this is the constructive way of looking at the world, is to say, yes, one can point fingers. And I'm not saying that you don't have a reason to. Sure, we can point fingers about, I don't know, crime levels are bad or education is bad, but there are also so many things that people can do about it. And I must just tell you that I think many people are. Sometimes we have this obsession with the things that you read in the newspaper and the leaders and so on. There are many, many great South Africans out there doing great things every day that we don't know about. You know, it's a little society, or they're doing something in their school, or they're teaching kids how to play a certain type of sport and so on. And I just try and associate with those people because that's what gives me energy.
It's a philosophical thing. I mean, effectively, I don't know what it is with you, but there's something, and maybe you can tell me, is there a core set of beliefs? Is there a religion? Is there a different way of looking at the world? Because I, on a good day when I'm integrated, like when everything's, when I'm looking at the world as a place I'm really excited to be a part of, then I can solve any problem.
Yeah.
But I've also had those days where,
where
everything presents itself as a threat to you and a problem, and you cannot see the wood for the trees. So how do you get out of those things?
I'm not even sure. It's not like I've got some unique process. It's just...
Do you realize when you're in them, though?
I think I've just over time, you've seen the good things that can happen. You know, you realize that there are certain people who can solve a problem and get on with it, and there are other people who moan, and you can decide, you know, in which of those two groups you want to be. I mean, if I can relate a simple story of when I still ran First National and I went on branch visits, you know, we had hundreds of them over the country, how you would go to one branch and...
Did they warn the people you were coming?
No, but they somehow found ways to know.
Okay.
And then you would have your typical chat to everybody, but at some stage the branch manager or manageress would say, can I talk to you? And you go and sit in the office. And they would, I'm giving you one example, would say, you know what, things aren't going well because our products are not good. And, you know, our brand is not great. And then the processes and the backup of support and our pricing. And I just want you to go and fix it. And you'd walk out of that office feeling quite depressed. And I'd go to the next branch and a similar thing would happen. And the branch manageress usually was the ladies who did really well there. They would say, I just want to tell you, our brand is doing so well. The products are flying. And it's this great support that we're getting. And this was the same brand, the same products, the same processes. And the difference was leadership. And it was interesting to me, and I could see this statistically, that the branch managers who complained were the ones doing badly, and the ones who were flying were the ones who, you know, somehow just had a different attitude. So call it a case study or a laboratory that we had there. But it really is like that. Great people make problems disappear and
problem people
just point out all the problems. Now, again, I'm not saying they are wrong. It's just a different attitude. And it's very difficult to explain people who are in that mindset to say, actually, have you ever thought about the fact that you may be the problem?
Have you read Yuval Noah Harari's Sapiens?
Yeah, I have.
He talks about how money is actually just a made-up thing.
It's a myth. Right? It's a myth, like many other myths that we have around
and
us.
And we all buy into it. That's how it exists. That's how it keeps existing.
Yeah.
And when you hear about a great idea that has taken off, it's usually because a lot of people bought into it.
Yes.
Either, you know, practically bought into it actually with their minds gone, I want to be a part of that.
That's what we've done as a society. And we often then look at other groups and what they've adopted. And if they, you know, I don't know whether it's a public corporation or a central bank or a government or a court system or whatever. But all these things, according to that book, and it's actually true, are myths. But they're very useful myths. Myths that we have created.
That allow us to cooperate.
Make society move forward.
What about Bank Zero? I mean, what's the value? You gave us a good value proposition for Rain.
Yeah.
What about Bank Zero?
So the basic thing here is this explosion in smartphones. The mobile revolution must be one of the biggest macro trends that we have in our society.
Absolutely.
And they actually not mobile phones, even saying the word phone is the wrong thing. It's a mobile device where, you know, some people still phone on them, but you actually basically do everything else on them. You know, whether you ask something out of Google or you find a map so you can find your way to Cliff Central, whatever it is. It's exploding. They're becoming cheaper and cheaper. There are really good smartphones on the market now for $1,500, and it will become less and less. Data costs are coming down, and we spoke about Rain earlier. Now, if you start thinking about banking And you had to design it on a clean sheet of paper, which, by the way, is a really good way to start a startup, is to say, like, what would you do today? You probably wouldn't start with big head offices, and you probably wouldn't start with a huge branch infrastructure around the country. You would say, I'm going to optimize this thing for mobile only, mobile first, mobile, and make it all digital. And that's what the small team did, run by a guy, Yatin Narsi. We also worked together many years ago. A very interesting character with whom I've had the most vociferous debates, but often those are interesting people, you know, people that you...
I love talking to people I disagree with.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because
best way to spend your time.
Sometimes he won, sometimes I won, but in the end, the solution was better. And we kept in contact after I'd left, and this idea of starting a mobile bank emerged. Mm-hmm. So you design things completely differently. You can create a whole lot of new functionality that you just couldn't do if you come from the old way of thinking. You can do it with new technology that is incredibly cheap. You know, in the old days, everything had to be on a huge computer infrastructure. Now it can be in the cloud. You had old computer development languages that are now, the developers on scarce supply, whereas now you can go to code sharing websites that, you know, a whole lot of people have done all the work for you, whether it's an HR system or finance system, and you can put it all together, and with an extremely low cost base, you can offer banking solutions to customers for a very low price. Now, I'm not going to reveal the price, although I can say that the bank's name is a hint, you know, what electronic banking fees are going to be. So we're going to have a mobile bank with a card, because you still need a card when you want to draw cash and, you know, kind of swipe in real situations. But we think if we can reduce the cost of banking and make it very, very low in South Africa, that will not only allow a whole lot of people that currently don't have bank accounts to get them.
Do you know what that number is? Because I've heard it's enormous, the number of people who are just not even in the formal economy.
Look, South Africa's actually done quite well in getting people who are economically active to open bank accounts. So there are a lot of people who actually don't have regular income going in, and for them it doesn't make sense to open a bank account, even if the monthly fee is R5, because they don't regularly have money going in there. We are obviously interested in them. We're also interested in stokvels, because that's a whole savings culture in South Africa. We have a society that's highly leveraged, but we want to promote savings, and stokvels is a great way of doing it. And then we're particularly going to focus on small businesses, or the business segment, which is a little bit of a neglected one, we think, in the South African banking segment.
Although it gets a lot of lip service from everybody.
It does. So we're not in the first instance going to finance them. You know, that'll come later. But we do think that your typical business pays a very high amount in bank fees, and if we can relieve them of that burden, that makes them more competitive, and it's money that you free up for them to do something elsewhere. We haven't launched yet. That's all going to happen in 2019, but we've got a small team of really, really competent people that really have a mission of changing banking in South Africa. And I was speaking much earlier about startups and giving you a sense of purpose. And it's great if you have that sense of purpose, that we think we're going to bring something really cool to South Africans, not only in functionality, but also in price, and challenge the conventional way of doing banking and paying for it, sometimes at very high rates. So you'll just have to wait to see when we launch in 2019, but it's going to be very exciting.
I'm sure that the big four in South Africa, big five if you include, I'm sure they're thrilled that you're doing this.
The competition's good, right? And the ultimate beneficiary is going to be the consumer in South Africa.
I know, but you know, the people who are currently in control of those places can't be charmed by this idea. They must feel a little bit threatened. Have you heard from anybody who maybe thinks that you've turned your back on your origins? You know how that stuff goes. People expect you to be a part of the family.
I personally felt quite bad in the sense that I will next year be competing with my old team, my old baby. Sure. Because, you know, when I ran the bank, it was everything. It was me. I mean, I thought of it every single hour of the day, and there are many good friends that are working there. I actually, you know, before we announced this to the world, went to all of them and explained that it's been a long time. It's been nearly 6 years since I left them. I am still in my heart a banker. It's what I know. It's what I studied. It's what I read books about. And at some stage, I was going to do this. But, you know, I'm not going to say that was easy for me, because I have a whole lot of respect for all the people there. At the same time, though, I really do believe that competition is good, and I really do believe that if we challenge them, they're going to lift up their game.
Did they take it okay?
Yeah, everyone's been very gentlemanly and actually said, you know, we wish you luck, you know. So, I kind of hats off to them. But if you, let's say you're a great rugby player. You don't always just want to play for the Curry Cup. You want to start for Super Rugby. You want to play for your country. And you don't then just want to play against Japan. You want to play against the best in the world and beat them. You know, and so I do believe that we have a thriving, competitive South African banking sector that's going to rise to the challenge. It's not going to be easy. We're going to be a small little startup. But sometimes David can do quite well in a battle.
Do your kids know what kind of things you've done? Are they aware of that? Do they think dad's just this businessman? I mean, how do they kind of figure you? Have you asked them? I don't know.
I think they're confused. My youngest has come to me and said, like, Dad, what do you do? Yeah. What do you really do in the office there all day? And, you know, how do you earn a salary and so on? And I'm not quite sure what they tell other kids. But
because you know they have those days at school where you have to explain what your parents do.
Yeah, I think they much preferred when I still was at FNB because it was much easier to explain to everyone else.
He's a banker.
But we, both my wife and I, and she actually runs the wine farm, we try very hard to let our kids grow up into people who are problem solvers. It's very clear that the disciplines that kids are learning at school and even at varsity are no longer going to be highly relevant by the time that they hit the world in 20 years' time. So while there's kind of still value maybe in the process, in discipline and hard work, and in some cases memorization, not in every single case, and in logic and the kind of things they teach you at school, it's more the abstract nature of those things that has some importance.
For some parents, that's the opposite of what they're doing. They are solving their kids' problems. There's this generation of kids who are being coddled, really, by everything, society, the internet, their school teachers, their parents, everyone's solving their problems for them.
And you should be doing the opposite, because the people that are going to do well and thrive, survive and thrive, are the ones that are going to understand the complexities of society and that solutions are going to be multidisciplinary. You're going to, I don't know, sometimes take a bit of finance and maths, but you're going to marry it with something that you learned in engineering to come up with a new device and technology, etc. But problem solving or complex problem solving is in the first instance attitudinal, giving your kids the attitude that they can come up with good ideas and then solve problems. You ask me what they think of me. I hope that they see me as somebody who in their daily interactions with them tries to stimulate them to look at solutions. That's kind of the best you can do to set them up for success in life.
That sounds so straightforward, though, when you put it the way you explain it.
Not easy.
But you, I'm sure you're sick of everybody coming to you to try and solve their problems, because you've developed a reputation for being one of these people who, even if your kids don't know it yet, that's what people think of you. And there must be a million entrepreneurs with an idea who are constantly trying to get your attention to talk about their idea.
Yeah, you do get a lot of coffee invites, many more coffees than a man can drink in one day and ever sleep again.
Yeah, but you're a nice human being. I mean, in this little bit of time I've spent with you, you seem to me to be a very you're a well-mannered, kind guy. You want to help people, but you can't.
I do want to help. What I can't do is I can't see everyone. They're just too many invites. But I do try and reply to every email I get. I do try and reply in Twitter on DMs, which is tough. But remember, sometimes the reply doesn't have to be five sentences. It could be a few words steering people. And really, this message of the idea isn't what it's about. It's about execution. It's still a revelation to many, many people. Yeah. So they want to come and share their idea with me and get my feedback. And in most instances, ideas are great. Like, people are kind of shocked when you tell them that. And they say, like, actually, I can't fault the idea, but that is not the thing. It's, you've got to go and implement it. And as I said to you earlier, you've got to go implement it on a very, very small scale. Do it in a way that's very lean. It doesn't have to cost you a lot of money.
Yeah.
And then learn. And then you are probably going to get better feedback from your first customer than you're going to get from me.
Right.
Listen to your first 10 customers. Listen to your first 100 customers. If you can make 100 people really, really happy, you're going to have a great business. You know, see me maybe as just one potential customer, but I don't have any unique wisdom that they don't have. I probably know less, you know. So that would be, yes, I go back to a lot of people, but that would be my advice, is I think there's nothing wrong with your idea, and you will only really know once you put it to the test in the market.
Just send them to the podcast. They can listen to that. You don't have to repeat yourself.
Thank you. I'm going to definitely do that. So if, I don't know which minute we're in now, but
Is there an old boys club in terms of people who've done as well as you've done in business? You kind of have your... Because, again, this is a perception people have, that you can pick up the phone and you can get hold of this one and that one, and that you guys all get together. And, I mean, they forget that you're a dad, you're a husband. You also have normal things going on in your life. It's not all exciting startup stuff and talking about the grand schemes and solving the big problems. Sometimes it's kind of ordinary stuff too, and you've probably got a circle of friends you've known since high school or varsity.
Yeah, so what there definitely isn't, or in my case isn't, is like a kind of bunch of high profile people that get together and kind of discuss what the gold price is going to be the next day. And if anything, I've tried to avoid any of those clubs and cliques and networks and so on. Now, that's just kind of partly my personality. But, what I do like is if I've got a few mates and we're going to go on a mountain biking trip in a week's time and we're going to, probably drink far too much wine at night and just talk nonsense and laugh. Lovely. And so on. Those are the type of things that give me a kick now. I very deliberately try to not use I don't think Filofaxes exist anymore, but all the business cards that I've accumulated over my life.
Before Filofax, they said Rolodex.
Before Rolodex, that's right. I nearly said Rolodex. So my game has not been about relationships in that sense. I'm not saying building relationships isn't kind of a really important thing, but I wouldn't want anyone to do business with me purely because of relationships. I'd rather have a product that is better or a service that is better and that because I know more about the topic in itself, and that will ultimately be the thing that make me win.
You don't have any of those kinds of, those artificial...
No, and I don't want to go to any clubs or meetings. No. I certainly don't want to go to anything where I have to ever put on a suit again so on.
Well, you're wearing jeans and an open neck shirt now, but I mean, you used to dress in a suit every other day, but when you were in the corporate world,
So now this is a very interesting aspect of venture capital, and I picked this up in Silicon Valley, is they said if somebody comes and pitches their business plan to you in a suit, just say no. Because I've had an incredibly bad track record on people in suits. So if somebody is really... If they know their topic so well, if they're so confident about what, the problem that they're solving, they will convince you with their substance. They don't need form to prove to you that that's how they're going to solve the problem, which is why the culture in Silicon Valley, which I really enjoyed, was completely informal. It wasn't about what people were wearing, and yet they were some of the smartest people that I'd ever met.
And here I was almost feeling bad that I was here in jeans and a T-shirt to interview you. I was worried about
it. Not at all, as long. In fact, I think if you kind of dress informally, there, you nearly put more pressure on yourself to show substance. And then the argument that you make has to be better. The points that you bring across, it's far more important because you don't have a Hermes tie or a boss suit to impress people with.
So you mentioned mountain biking twice, but isn't that dangerous? I mean, I've heard of people who've gone over the handlebars and they end up with brain problems.
I've fallen.
Mountain biking's not for... You can't just summer do it.
I've injured myself, and I'm now maybe at the stage of life where I'm taking a little bit more easy and kind of break a little bit more. Although interestingly, in mountain biking they say speed is your friend. Don't break too much. You're going downhill, which is also one of the lessons in life, right? If you break too often, sometimes it's actually better to just go over that boulder. The other thing is to keep your line, choose a line and kind of stick to it, which I suppose also has some lessons in life, look a little bit further out and choose your line. But I describe myself as a lazy mountain biker. I'm sure my mates would agree with that. I'm definitely not the guy riding in front, but I love it. It's great to be out there. I'm privileged that, we live in a mountainous area. I also often listen to podcasts, while I mountain bike, because mountain biking can take two and a half, three hours. And then it's nice to actually, listen to a few podcasts as well. So it's a great time to be out in nature. It's a great time to look after your body. And then, you can use it to also fill up your brain.
Well, isn't it nice to be a little bit selfish sometimes? Like, that's your time.
Yeah, that's right? Exactly
and,
right.
And people forget this. They think that selfishness is an evil, that you're putting yourself in a position of prominence or preference over others. That's not what it is. It's dedicating a little time to nurturing yourself so your cup is full enough to help other people.
Well, it's that in the first instance. But the second point really is being healthy, looking after your body. And
if you're in survival mode, you're not optimal.
You're definitely not. And you're going to have those fight-flight things rather than think deeply about problems. I have to say that when I was CEO of the bank, I probably didn't look after my body the way I should have. It was always the thing that I would push out. So let's say I said to myself I was going to go to the gym later in the day, but if a problem cropped up, I would just easily push out the gym session and so on. So it's something that I've taken up with a little bit more vigor since I left that job. You know, Warren Buffett, he tells quite a long story, but, you know, people were asking him about investments, and he said, if you could choose only one car in your life, imagine the car you would choose. And everybody came up with, you know, kind of really, really cool cars. And he said, but now, if that's the only car that you're going to keep for the rest of your life, will the decision be the same one as if I just said choose a car? And everybody changed, you know, kind of what car they would want. And he said, but now that is your body. You only get one body and you've got to look after it for the rest of your life. So it's all these people who wanted financial wisdom from Warren Buffett walked away saying,
with
the most
advice.
Important thing that I can do is look after the thing that I've only got one of, which is my body.
Yeah, there's only one Michael Jordan. I'm very pleased that we got to spend some time together. I mean, we didn't get to go in every direction, but you're also the kind of guy who I think you could talk about a lot of things and you'd be interesting on many of them.
Life is interesting.
No, I'm just,
I have strong views on a whole lot of stuff, but as I said earlier, very weakly held.
No, but I like that you are, because I do occasionally see like some very strident opinion, but it's always with the intention of making things more interesting or better. And I believe many people will benefit from some of the things you've said here. And I also think that, you know what, you've been a very normal human, down to earth guy in this discussion, which I think a lot of people would also be surprised by. I wasn't. I was kind of expecting this. I'm glad. I'm very glad. To
I had
you.
A great talk as well, and you know, I hope we do it again in future. Thanks,
Gareth. Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a safe trip back.
I shall do so, but first I'm going to enjoy the hospitality and great food that Joburg has to offer tonight.
That you never hear from a Cape Townian.
No, you really have some great restaurants here. I'm not going to mention any, but I look forward to going out
Thank
tonight.
You so much, Michael.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
This is CliffCentral.com.